From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Jing Xuing Li. He's a business reporter in VOA's Mandarin service. Our topic on this edition of the program, has the United States averted a trade war with China? What is the best way to counter China's unfair trading practices and theft of intellectual property? Are the more protectionist policies emanating from the Trump administration better than managing the difficulties of globalization and free trade? Or do the costs of such policies outweigh the benefits, given that the world's economies are so inextricably intertwined? Well, these are just some of the questions we'll be asking our special guest, William Reinsch. He's senior advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, specializing in trade policy. Previously, he served for 15 years as president of the National Foreign Trade Council, where he led efforts in favor of open markets, in support of the Export-Import Bank, and the Overseas Private Investment Corporation. From 2000 to 2016, he concurrently served as a member of the U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission. He also teaches courses in globalization, trade policy, and politics at the School of Public Policy at the University of Maryland. William Reinsch also served as the Undersecretary of Commerce for Export Administration during the Bill Clinton administration. Prior to that, he spent 20 years on Capitol Hill, most of them as senior legislative assistant to the late Senator John Hines, a Republican from the state of Pennsylvania, and subsequently to Senator John D. Rockefeller, a Democrat from the state of West Virginia. William Reinsch joins us here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
And I'm delighted to welcome my colleague, Jing Xuing Li. He's a business reporter in VOA's Mandarin service.
Hi, Carol. Glad to be here.
William Reinsch, so much to talk about. Let's get right into the topic of the pros and the cons of the trade policy we're seeing emanating from the Trump administration. Do you think it's a good idea for the Trump administration to impose tariffs? We heard about these tariffs back in March. First, there were some solar panels, washing machines, then later on imported steel and aluminum from a range of countries, both U.S. allies and China. What's your sense of this particular policy?
Tariffs are generally a bad idea. They distort market forces. They force companies to alter their supply chains. They increase cost to consumers. And they also prompt retaliation. In the case you're talking about, when the president announced his tariffs that were going to be on $50 billion of Chinese goods, the Chinese response was to say, we will do the same thing back. And they put out their list of American goods on which there will be tariffs of $50 billion. So for American consumers, flat panel displays in particular will become 25% more expensive if all this actually ends up happening.
Why did the president want to use this policy?
Well, there's been a lot of discussion about that. I think a significant part of it is he just likes tariffs. It seems to be his preferred remedy for everything in trade. In the Chinese case in particular, there was an investigation under what's called Section 301 of U.S. law, which asked the government to determine whether the other country is engaging in unreasonable or discriminatory or unfair practices. And that report concluded that China was doing that. And the report focused primarily on theft of intellectual property, forced technology transfer. That is, a condition of joining a joint venture would be that you had to transfer technology, and discrimination against U.S. companies that are operating in China, that they're not treated just as Chinese companies are being treated. A number of different things you could do about that. The point of the law is usually to force a negotiation. What the president did is he went straight to the penalty phase and announced that he was going to impose these tariffs, and then he deferred actually doing that pending a negotiation, which we've been having for the last month or two.
Now, do you think there may be domestic political reasons for which President Trump is doing this? I know he's concerned about steel manufacturers here in the United States, and that seems to be, that is, his tariffs on imported steel seems to please some of these dying steel mills. On the other hand, he has riled up other manufacturers of, for example, value-added products that use imported steel. So it looks like he's trying to pick winners and losers, and that doesn't seem to be working out in the long run.
I think the president's view, and I think historians will say this is a weakness, is that he doesn't see himself as the president of all the people. He sees himself as the president of the people who voted for him. And the people that voted for him and put him over the top are the people in Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, Indiana, Wisconsin, the so-called Rust Belt states that have suffered from a decline of manufacturing, have lost jobs. And he promised to take care of them in the campaign. And I think what he's trying to do in the trade area is an effort to do that, to make them feel better, to address their concerns. Whether it'll do it or not is a different question, but I think that's his motivation.
Mr. Reinsch, can you tell us on how the tariff would likely to invite the retaliation in history? Is there any good cases you can tell us?
Well, yes. The most obvious one was the famous chicken war that we had with Western Europe in the 1960s. The Europeans decided that they didn't want to import any more American chickens. That was protectionist. They had chicken farmers who didn't want any more. It wasn't a deep philosophical issue. So they imposed a tariff on American chickens. We attempted to negotiate. This was in the Kennedy and then the Johnson administrations. We attempted to negotiate with them. We did not succeed. So we retaliated, and we imposed a 25% tariff on trucks, which at the time affected Volkswagen and Mercedes, which would make sense because we were basically going after the Germans. That still exists. Now, more than 50 years later, we still have a 25% truck tariff, and it hurts the Koreans and the Japanese a lot more than it does the Germans, but it's still there.
Well, Mr. Reinsch, that leads me to ask you, because you talked about Western Europe with respect to the chicken tariffs, many European allies are upset about the imposition of tariffs on steel and aluminum because they also are affected. And then they came back with, okay, we're going to put tariffs on bourbon and Harley-Davidson. So it's sort of exemplifying your arguments about this tit-for-tat and how it escalates into something, which is perhaps disconcerting because even though it also affects adversaries like China, it equally, if not more so, impacts or has an impact on our allies. That may be another reason for concern.
Yes, it's made a lot of waves. Keep in mind, too, that the retaliation is usually artfully chosen. You're right about the bourbon and the Harleys, and there's a reason why. Most of bourbon is made in Kentucky, which is the state of the Senate majority leader. Harley-Davidsons are made in Wisconsin, which is the state of the Speaker of the House. Usually when other countries retaliate, and the Chinese have done something similar, is they're good at maximizing political pain by picking out products that are made in places where people are politically important.
It seems that this time we have seen the Chinese side retaliate U.S. tariff by using the soybean.
And why is that why so is important that? And significant? Mm.
Because it's a lot of money. It's several billion dollars and a significant element of agriculture exports in the Midwest in all the states that voted for the president. Nebraska, Iowa, Kansas, the Dakotas, all over the Midwest. It's a huge issue there. It's not just soybeans. The pork producers put out a statement recently where they talked about how much they've lost in income just because of the uncertainty that the tariffs have generated in the marketplace. I mean, they're not in place, but if you anticipate that they're going to be in place and you're buying pork, then you look for another source of supply.
So if I understand you, Mr. Reinsch, the imposition of tariffs on imported goods adversely affects, in many cases, the American consumer, who often benefits from these cheaper imported products, which would then cost more if those tariffs are imposed. And yet Mr. Trump says, well, it's easy to win a trade war.
I think he's wrong about that. Tariffs in particular are a sort of a lose-lose strategy. If you put tariffs on Chinese goods, then you make them more expensive for American consumers. If you put tariffs on cars, for example, as another thing he announced separately, you know, that means that if he actually does that, Japanese, Korean, European cars are going to cost 25% more. For a car, that's a lot of money. But it's lose-lose because the other country retaliates and they put tariffs on your stuff. So if you're an American exporter, if you're an American farmer in particular, you're going to lose market share because agriculture in particular, these are what are called commodity products. A soybean is a soybean. And I don't think the Chinese care too much whether they get it from Brazil or whether they get it from the United States. They'll get it where the quality is acceptable and the price is cheap. If they decide not to buy from the United States as an act of retaliation, they'll go to Brazil. Our farmers lose. The Brazilian farmers are very happy.
We've learned this new development. Can we say that based on what you just taught us, soybean became a major factor, affect the final decision of the U.S. delegation when they negotiate with China?
I don't know. There has been a debate inside the administration over what we really want from China in this exercise. The report that was done talked about technology and intellectual property and some very difficult, complicated issues. The president has spent more time talking about the size of the overall bilateral deficit and his desire to reduce that. If China were to buy more soybeans and more wheat, more corn, more natural gas, which is actually one of the things they negotiated, that would bring down the size of the deficit. It would do nothing about the other technology and intellectual property problems that have been identified.
We're going to get into that in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is William Reinsch, senior advisor specializing in international trade at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and that's a think tank based here in Washington. Previously, he served as Undersecretary of Commerce for Export Administration during the Bill Clinton administration. I'm Carol Castiel, along with Jing Xuing Li. He's a business reporter in VOA's Mandarin service. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to loyal listener William Kokulu from Monrovia, Liberia. Thanks for your email, William. If you want to hear your name on the air, give us some feedback on this show by sending an email to PCUSA@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our special guest, William Reinsch. And before we went to the break, William, we were talking about this so-called this trade deficit with China, that is between China and the United States, that Mr. Trump is worried about. But let me quote Christine Lagarde, the director of the International Monetary Fund, with respect to the Trump administration's threat to impose tariffs on Chinese goods. She says that these tariffs are rocking the boat of the global economy. And she said, quote, a trade deficit is not reason enough to impose tariffs. And she says it's not the right way to go on trade. How do you see that?
Most economists would agree with Madame Lagarde that a trade deficit is not an accurate indicator of the state of the economy. There is, however, I think, a growing minority in the economic community that would say that a very large trade deficit that is sustained for a very long period of time does pose a risk to the country that has it, because it ultimately erodes confidence in the ability of that government to manage its economy and manage its affairs. The United States has had a trade deficit since 1975. That was the last year we had a surplus. It's leveled off some in recent years, but it's beginning to grow again, and it will grow fairly significantly, I think, because of the tax bill that was passed last year. So it's going to be back on the front page as an issue. The irony of the debate is the actions the administration has taken so far, namely the tax bill, will make that worse, not better.
Quickly, a follow-up. And, you know, given what you said, that the real questions, the real points of contention between China and the United States and between China and many other countries around the world is the fact that the Chinese are stealing intellectual property and engaging in unfair trading practices. Their government forces American firms to form joint ventures with Chinese companies, which then results in this widespread theft of intellectual property. American firms face Chinese competition that receive heavy state subsidies. So the question is to you, an expert, if the imposition of tariffs is not really the way to go or a halfway measure, what would be, in your view, the best remedy to counter these unfair trading practices on the part of China?
That gets asked a lot, and the answers fall into two categories. One is, how do you influence the Chinese to change their policies? And the other is, how do you develop appropriate countermeasures? Let's put it that way. With respect to the first, my experience with the Chinese, and I think other people would say the same thing, is that they don't like being an outlier. They don't like being the only one in the world engaging in a particular practice. So if you build a coalition and get everyone else saying to them the same thing at the same time at a very high level, that their policies are unacceptable, then you can make some progress. That means building a coalition of the Europeans, the Japanese, the Koreans, the Australians, the Indians, the South Africans, hopefully the Russians. This has been done before. President Obama did it when the Chinese put out a policy called Indigenous Innovation, which is basically buy Chinese and don't buy foreign policy. And essentially, by getting the rest of the world to gang up on them, they withdrew that policy. So coalition building is one way to do it. Bilateral negotiations don't generally work.
Yeah.
I think the other part, the countermeasures I described, is thinking about how much you can realistically accomplish with China on matters that are difficult for them. We're asking a lot of them on the technology front. And I think in many respects, the real battleground is in third countries and in the United States. And what the United States needs to think about is how can we enable our companies that compete with China's companies to be better competitors in Europe, in the rest of Asia, in India, when they go head-to-head against China on neutral ground.
Talking about the Chinese industrial policy, we heard a lot recently on the Made in China 2025. What is the significance of this Chinese industrial policy to the U.S.?
Well, it's a source of great concern on a couple levels. What it basically does is list a number of sectors, all high-tech sectors, where the Chinese government says, we are going to create a global champion. And what the global champion is going to do is going to outcompete everybody else, including outcompete the Americans. So the message to American companies, if you look at the last 10 years of history, is, we're going to take your technology, legally or illegally, and then we're going to use it to build a better you, and then we're going to destroy you. So you can imagine why American companies are not excited about that sequence of events. If you look at it as a legal matter, it's an issue of subsidies and government support. China belongs to the World Trade Organization, and once you join the World Trade Organization, you agree to their rules. And their rules include rules on granting subsidies. And you're not supposed to give subsidies if it will create a competitive advantage when it comes to exports for you. And that's exactly what the Chinese are doing. They've announced $150 billion U.S. dollar fund to build up their semiconductor industry. Mm-hmm. They're going to use that to build some 30 additional fab plants for semiconductors. And they'll create a world-class industry on government money. That's a violation of WTO rules. And rather than wait until they've already done it and our companies are going out of business, the United States is trying to do something about it in advance.
They are?
Well, through the 301 case, through the tariffs. Now, you didn't ask me if that's the right thing to do.
Right.
But that's what that's the problem that they are ostensibly trying to solve.
Exactly. Well, so let's get to that. And that is, if the so-called punishment doesn't fit the crime, i.e., if the tariffs approach hurts U.S. industry and consumers and doesn't really penalize China for these major unfair trading practices, the theft of intellectual property, and all that you just spoke about, then why not use, for example, the WTO? Would the WTO be a better mechanism through which to address this? And if it is, why is the Trump administration averse to such a multilateral mechanism and cooperating, as you said, building a coalition with allies to thwart China?
Well, that's two separate questions. They're not exactly averse to using the WTO. I'm not sure they're a big fan, but they actually have launched a complaint at the WTO over exactly the issues we're talking about, and that's moving forward. It is also the case, if you look just at the example I cited, which is semiconductors and subsidies, we have laws that are WTO consistent that provide tools to deal with that. If they're subsidizing, it allows us to assess a tariff that would offset the amount of the subsidy. That's okay under WTO rules. That's what we did in steel. That's why the Chinese are no longer a big factor in the American marketplace for steel. We knocked them out by filing lots and lots of subsidy cases and dumping cases.
But that was before the Trump administration?
Before and during.
And during.
Still going on. But they tend to be after the fact, because in order to win one of those cases, you have to prove, first, that the Chinese are doing something wrong, but you also have to prove that you've been injured by it. And usually proving that you've been injured by it means some time has to pass for you to suffer. Now, you can argue that you're threatened with injury, and you can win on that, but that's also difficult to prove because nothing has actually happened. But the tools are there. Now, your other question, why haven't we built a coalition, is a more important question. And I think there it's clear that that's not a priority for this administration. The president prefers to approach things bilaterally. He said this many times. He doesn't favor regional agreements. He pulled out of TPP, which would have been a very effective tool for dealing with China. He's not pursued the parallel European agreement, TTIP. He's prefers to go it alone, and I think that's a mistake. He may come back to it. I noticed that the OECD is having a minister-level meeting at the end of May, and the U.S. Trade Representative and the European Commission Trade Minister and the Japanese Minister will all be there and will be meeting to follow up a meeting they had in Buenos Aires at the WTO ministerial meeting late last year, where the three of them agreed on joint action to press China on the IP and tech transfer issues that we've been talking about. So, you know, there are some small wheels turning, but the big coalition that would be necessary is not happening.
Quick question about this. When we're talking about the coalition, and we also heard a lot of people's concern about U.S. might hurt its allies. So can you explain this to us?
Well, that's one of the mysteries of the process. You know, we live in a world where everything is made everywhere. And when you propose widespread tariffs, as the president has on steel, or as he proposed to do on cars, you offend a lot of people, not just one or two. And in the steel case, for example, some of the biggest steel producers are Japan, Korea, and a number of countries in the European Union. So we are irritating our friends, and we are irritating people that we will need to help us later on in other issues, like in dealing with China.
William Reinsch, could you bring us up to date about what is going on with ZTE? And that's one of the world's largest telecom companies. It's Chinese. It looks like it might be becoming a bargaining chip. Let me remind our listeners, Mr. Trump settled on a so-called ZTE deal in recent days that would require the nation to pay, that is China, to pay a $1.3 billion fine. You know, it had to suspend its operations after it was barred in 2016 from doing business in the United States for violating sanctions against Iran and North Korea. Now, this deal that's on the table is unpopular with both Democrats and Republicans, who say that ZTE will crush U.S. companies and spy and steal from the United States. So if ZTE violated these sanctions on Iran and North Korea, why would the United States risk lifting sanctions and therefore perhaps endangering our national security? Or is getting Chinese cooperation, let's say, on North Korea, does that somehow outweigh the national security risks of dealing with ZTE? How do you see that dilemma?
I think that's probably the only logical explanation. I gather President Xi Jinping asked President Trump to do that, and the president took the request seriously. I think probably it's in the context of the Korea negotiations. It's irritated a lot of people. It's irritated first the law enforcement community, because this is not a trade action that is a matter of policy. This is a crime. ZTE products, because they contain American components, are subject to American export control laws and American sanctions laws. And this is also a case, if you remember, if you're not nearly old enough to remember Watergate, but if you're old like me and remember Watergate, this is a case where the cover-up is worse than the crime in some respects. ZTE cheated. They sold items to North Korea and Iran that they were not allowed to sell, and they tried to cover that up. They were caught. In 2016, they paid a fine of nearly $1.2 billion at that point, promised to clean house internally and to do a number of other things, which they did not do. And they lied about not doing it. So they were caught again this year, at which point the original penalty, which was what's called a denial order that told the Americans who sell them parts and components may not do that any longer. That was suspended in 2016 in return for the fine and the change in behavior, which is very common. And this is the bureau I used to run at the Commerce Department, so I'm familiar with the procedure. It's fairly common to suspend the worst penalty in favor of something else. So they did that. But when they came back and got caught basically covering up, the initial government action was to go back to the original penalty and tell U.S. companies, you may no longer sell ZTE chips or other parts and components that they depend on. That put them out of business. That caused the president of China to appeal to the president of the United States. Enforcement community is angry because this is a law enforcement issue.
Right.
This is a criminal issue, which they don't think should be negotiable as a trade issue. The Congress is angry because they believe that ZTE is a security risk because it's acting as an agent of the Chinese government, that its products are infected, if you will, that allow people who use their products to be accessed by the Chinese government. The irony, of course, is that the Chinese government believes exactly the same thing about American products. There's a huge wall of suspicion here. Mm-hmm. But everybody's kind of upset about it, and the settlement for another fine and more behavioral changes, I think, has not made very many people happy.
No, indeed. So, there is a bipartisan group of senators, as I said, that are very concerned. And the mixed messages we get from Mr. Trump are also a bit confusing. He's also worried about jobs, ZTE jobs. So that sends a contradictory message, both on the job front. We thought he was more concerned about U.S. jobs. And at the same time, this national security risk
and
is very disconcerting.
And also there's a saying about make America great again or make China great again.
Some people are joking that he's making China great.
Yeah.
There are a lot of American jobs wrapped up in that, too, and not just ZTE employees in the United States, but, you know, all that stuff that the Americans sell them. Qualcomm, for example, sells them, you know, lots of chips that go into their technology. Those jobs are at risk, too. So it's a complicated decision. I never second guess law enforcement when they make a decision, but they've kind of dug their own hole here. And the president, in trying to dig out of it, only has subjected himself to charges that he's soft on China. And I think, frankly, that's part of the reason why, after that happened, he then announced that he was actually going to impose the tariffs on $50 billion in Chinese goods that he announced at the end of the 301 investigation several months ago. And then he postponed those, and now he says he's going to put them in place as of June 15th. I think that's a reaction to the criticism he got.
So what kind of consequences do you think we will see?
Consequences.
Yeah, to this newly announced tariff.
Well, one is certain, because the Chinese have said very clearly and publicly that if the United States imposes tariffs on $50 billion of Chinese goods, the Chinese will impose tariffs on $50 billion of U.S. goods, and they've already put out their list of what those goods will be. So you can identify who the winners and losers will be, and there will be lots of losers on both sides. The unknown question, I think, is how this will affect efforts to negotiate solutions to all these problems. There was a negotiation recently in Beijing that did not produce a measurable outcome. It produced some Chinese promises that were not paired with actual numbers of what they were going to do. Secretary Ross then announced that he was going to go back to Beijing a second time to try to pin that down and put some specific numbers and negotiate specific concrete agreements that will commit the Chinese to buy more of specified products. One consequence may be that the Chinese cancel that trip. It wouldn't surprise me if they did that. If they allow the trip to go forward, it'll almost certainly make the outcome more difficult.
Well, William Reinsch, I want to correct you. Earlier you said that I don't remember Watergate. I was young, but I do remember it. But thanks for the compliment. William Reinsch is a former senior U.S. government official, now a senior advisor on international trade at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. William Reinsch, thank you so much for sharing your terrific insights on this complicated but very fascinating topic of international trade.
Happy to be here. Thank you very much.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Our engineer was Pete Hundley. And joining me on the program was Jing Xuing Li. He's a business reporter in VOA's Mandarin service. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.